All right, it's springtime, and you know what that means. It means summer is right around the corner, and you don't want to be spending these beautiful days inside cooking and chopping vegetables. No, you want to be outside enjoying fresh spring air, and you can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Because every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, it's dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in what? 2 minutes. You choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including calorie smart, keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie. Also discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. I love Factor meals. They're absolutely delicious. I don't have to worry about it. They're just in my fridge. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/queerthemusic50 and use code queerthemusic50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Queer the Music, the podcast from Mercury Studios, celebrating the LGBTQ plus anthems that have soundtracked queer lives. I'm Jake Shears, your host for this series, and I've been having a wonderful time meeting all these incredibly talented musicians, some of whom have been genuine role models for me, and hearing how they brought their songs to life has been fascinating and inspiring. My guest in this episode is a friend. He's someone I've admired and hung out with over the years, and I adore him and his music, Rufus Wainwright. Rufus was born into a music-making dynasty. His mother was folk legend Kate McGarrigle, his father, Loudon Wainwright III, and his sister is Martha Wainwright. Rufus was one of the very first artists signed to a mainstream record label who publicly identified as gay from the get-go. And he's been consistently involved in LGBTQ plus advocacy throughout his whole career. Since the 1990s, he's recorded 11 studio albums, written 2 classical operas, and won many awards in the process. I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm gonna see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America. The song we're talking about today is from his 5th studio album, 2007's Release the Stars. To give you some context, back then George W. Bush was 7 years into his presidency in the US and the war in Afghanistan was escalating. Gay marriage wasn't yet legal in most of the country, and there were only a small number of LGBTQ plus characters on TV and in music who were out publicly. I'm so tired of you, America, making my own way home. Ain't gonna be alone. I got a life to lead, America. I got a life. It might be hard to believe, but in 2007, it was still incredibly risky to be out, especially with a music career. Going to a Town was the first single from Rufus's album, and its critique of the United States and the war provoked very strong negative reactions in audiences. Bear in mind that just a few years earlier, country artists the Dixie Chicks, now known as the Chicks, experienced a terrifying backlash after criticizing the president over the war in Iraq. But Rufus didn't let that stop him. When he performed this track, he says, I would sing it often and get booed. It's only looking back now that I fully realize what a risk he was taking. But this is a song that's also garnered huge critical acclaim and has been covered by artists from George Michael to Lily Allen. So I was truly keen to know how it came to life and hear about his process. I'm so tired of you. Rufus Wainwright, it's so great to see you.
Great to see you too.
We are here to talk about Going to a Town. I wanted to start off by asking you sort of, I mean, I know you're coming off of Want One and Want Two, and what was going on in your life when you wrote that song? And I'd love to just talk about the specifics of where you were when you got the idea for it even.
I wrote it right after the invasion of Iraq by the United States during the Bush years. I, as well as the world, were pretty horrified by the turn of events which had occurred, meaning that, you know, 9/11 happened and everybody for a moment kind of gathered around the United States and really wanted to, you know, commiserate with us and make the world a better place and all of that stuff. And then all of a sudden we were invading Iraq, you know, which was obviously such a mistake. And anyway, so that happened. And so I wrote that song, Going to a Town. It's interesting because I still lived in the United States. And I still wanted to feel somewhat excited about it. So I wrote anti-American songs and listened to Judy Garland to kind of keep the scale even.
Can we talk about just your writing process for a moment and just like how, when you get the seed of an idea, how does it form initially?
Well, that one came in a flash. I think I wrote that song in about 2 or 3 minutes. Occasionally there are pieces that just arrive fully formed. And you just sort of shepherd them through. It doesn't happen often, but that was one of those occurrences.
Do you remember where you were when it came out?
Yes, because what it is that I'd met Jorn, my husband now, and we've been together for about 17 years now, and he lived in Berlin. And I had decided to go spend more time with him and hang out with him. And when I say going to a town that's already been burnt down, I'm referring to Berlin. And I think what I was just very affected by the kind of lesson that Germany had learned. Like, I don't say that lightly. I mean, there's a real proactive push in Germany to really examine the Second World War, especially. And there's a lot of monuments and, you know, so forth. So whereas in the United States, we're in a constant state of denial, lying, basically, about what happened. So I just felt the need to go to Berlin and be somewhere that acknowledged that it had experienced and caused, you know, horrific things in the world, as opposed to being this sort of weird American state of horrifying bliss. So that's the city that I'm referring to, going to a town. Yeah, and I mean, I think there's also certain lines like, you know, making my own way home, the idea of, you know, I'm no longer a child and I can, you know, walk myself to school. I don't need to be accompanied anymore, and using that as a kind of metaphor. So
I think that's the most moving part of the song right there when it sort of gets there. It's just like, it's gorgeous. And I also love the line of, paraphrasing now. What makes you think I'd go to hell for loving someone?
Yeah, well, the line is, do you really think you go to hell for having loved and not for thinking everything that you've done is good? What I like about that line is that it's obviously referring to, well, for me, maybe it's not even obvious, but for me, I'm referring to gay rights and all of that. Oh, after soaking the body of Jesus Christ in blood. Sorry, that's I was like, this isn't right. But yeah, the blood part does. Anyway.
Yes.
But it could be translated to many situations. Now I think about abortion, you know, going to hell for having loved. It's a similar kind of conundrum and whatever quagmire that America puts you in. So yeah, it's a very versatile statement, but totally, you know, American in nature.
Did you realize you were writing a protest song?
Well, I knew that I think mostly because it came so quickly and it was so kind of immediate, I knew that I was definitely expressing something strong and that it was current and it was, you know, visceral in terms of my reaction to what was happening in the world. Yeah, I think I knew pretty fast that it was, because I remember, it's funny, the first place I sang it, it was so interesting. It was at ABC Carpet and Home. For some, I don't know, I got roped into like doing some sort of like in-store ABC Carpet and Home. But I think it was a protest thing, because the woman who owns that place, I don't know if it's still her, but she was sort of active politically occasionally. And there was something maybe for abortion rights or something like, but it was really just a cocktail party for New Yorkers. And, but I sang it there, kind of surrounded by these, you know, rugs and throw pillows and stuff. Let's just say it wasn't like me on the steps of, you know, the Lincoln Memorial.
You know, you got to try stuff out somewhere when you're playing a new song.
What was great is that it even had an immediate effect there. People knew that something was going on. When people heard it at that point, even if you were, you know, sipping a cocktail and looking at baubles, you kind of realize that I'm So Tired of America really resonated. And maybe even more in that environment in a weird way.
When you went in to record the album, can you talk about just recording the album itself and recording this song and where the record was recorded?
I did go to Berlin to record the album. It was done in Berlin and in Brooklyn. You know, I think initially I did a week in Brooklyn, sorry, to get the basic tracks. And that was great. And I had, you know, Matt Johnson and my friend Joan Wasser and my sister Lucy. Like, they all kind of came in and put on a lot of the basic tracks.
I love Joan so much. People might know her better as the amazing Jonas Policewoman.
Yeah, no, she's amazing. Then I went to Berlin to really complete it. And I was recording at this incredible studio in Köpenick, which had been during the GDR, you know, when the wall was up. It was the main radio station for the East Germany. And it was this massive palatial building filled all of marble, like a real kind of fascist sort of communist structure, which apparently had the same marble in it that was in like Hitler's house or something in the mountains or something. Like, it had all this, it was very eerie. It looked like where Darth Vader would live or something. And so, and it was kind of run down and abandoned. And so I recorded in that studio. It was an incredible studio. And what's interesting about the process, though, is that, yes, I think I went to Berlin initially with the concept of being, you know, oh, this is going to be my rough, you know, cutting edge, dark Berlin record, like Bowie or Lou Reed or something. But then I actually got really influenced over there by Sans Souci and Frederick the Great. And I got really into like Baroque flute music, which is also oddly enough from that area. So the album had turned out to be quite flourished, and I wrote about like walking in the park and stuff. But yes, going to a town was me, you know, trying to be a little tougher.
Was Neil Tennant living in Berlin?
He was hanging out a lot. I don't think
he's got a house there.
Yeah, I don't think he had a place at that point, but he was definitely hanging out a lot in Berlin.
He executive produced the record.
Yeah, yeah. And we did do a lot of it in London as well to work with him. So yeah, no, he was intimately involved with the making of this record.
In what ways did he shape it?
Well, he's just very, I mean, Neil is famous for being brutally honest, you know, about what he thinks is happening. One would think, oh, maybe he should have come in there and like said, oh, well, I don't think this will make it to radio, and maybe you should cut verses here if you want it to be more accessible. Like, because he's been so popular, because the pet shop has been more popular, but he's really not like that. I think he appreciates my own kind of idiosyncrasies, and he wanted it to have that, as well as be, you know, accessible and sort of meaningful on a real level. So if anything, he was just there to sort of make me a little more streamlined, though still be very Rufus Wainwright in the end.
When Going to Town came out, was the reaction something that you expected? I mean, what was the reaction? Dixie Chicks, you know, 3 years before, had completely gotten canceled.
Yeah.
You know, was that on your mind?
Yeah, no, it was very, look, I love the video that we did, you know, with Sophie Mueller did this great video.
It's gorgeous.
I commend, actually, the record company, believe it or not, for having produced that video, allowed me to release it as a single, and also my management at the time. Like, we really did that. And no, it didn't shoot to the top of the charts, but what do you think? I mean, come on. That was not to be expected. But it did have a strong effect, and I did have people walk out of shows. I mean, I've had a couple of stories with that song. I mean, one time, you know, a woman came up to me, and she was like, how dare you do that? And then she basically had a nervous breakdown in front of me. She's like, my son is in the army, and how could you sing that? He's had to, like, he's killed babies and stuff. Like, she went on about how he was, like, responsible for killing a lot of, like, children in, like, some foreign war. I mean, like, and it really hit, like, a nerve with her. So she was like, how can you uncover, you know? I had another situation where I was playing with a symphony orchestra, and the trumpet player, the lead trumpet player, which is a big part of the orchestration, he walked out in the middle of the song in protest, which never happens, you know, especially in the classical world. So, and what's fascinating about it, actually, is that it's actually also switched sides, because when I first wrote it, it was Republicans who had a bad reaction. But then when Obama was in power, the Republicans loved it all of a sudden. You know, it became more of an anthem for people who hated Obama, you know, so.
But I mean, I think it's that adaptability of the song that you were mentioning earlier that fuels it to kind of keep going.
Yeah. Well, what's happening now is that it's no longer about political parties now. It's really about this fundamental warped direction that the United States has taken in terms of so many things, whether it's gay rights or abortion or, you know, voting rights. I mean, there's this Trump, love him or hate him. Well, mostly hate him, obviously, but in a weird way, not love him, but appreciate the fact that he opened the can of worms of stuff that's been there all along. And now we really have to deal with it. And it's pretty hairy.
You duetted with Anoni.
Yes.
You both covered this song for Folkocracy,
yes,
your most recent album. And it's very poignant, the two of you singing it and sort of like thinking about it through, you know, Anoni's lens.
Yes. No, totally.
In a certain way.
Yeah, totally.
Did you both have conversations about that when you were making this cover?
Look, I've known her for so long. I think, God, I knew of her when I first moved to New York when I was like 17 for a period. And I consider us very good friends. She's, you know, a complicated individual at times. We've had some ups and downs, not so much with us, but just in the lives that we've led. I don't know. I think also I've been somewhat jealous of her at times. I wouldn't dare say that she's been jealous of me, but she should be. But you know, when she got all that fame after the Mercury Prize, and, you know, and she was suddenly like, everybody was like, oh, she's a better singer than me. You know, like, there was a little bit of, we were kind of pitted against each other slightly, occasionally. Mm. And so when we were recording the song, you know, I was very excited for her to be on the song. And then she couldn't come into the studio because she was in New York and I was in LA. Anyways, we sent her the tracks and she sent back this recording and it made absolutely no sense. It was completely all over the place. Nobody could figure it out. So we kind of like edited it down to something which was very minimal, and then sent it back to her and said, this is sort of what we think you're trying to do. And then she said, oh no, you got it wrong. She's like, I haven't heard the lead vocal yet. She didn't listen to my lead vocal.
Okay.
To do this track. she wanted to do her own sort of interpretation without actually listening to mine. And it immediately was like, you fucking asshole. You know, of course you're not going to listen to my lead. Like, we kind of fell back into this, like, thing. But then she sent me what she was thinking and she kind of mixed it in a way that then suddenly made sense and it was great. And then I went back and we kind of fixed it, and it turned out to be something really great. But it was definitely imbued with a sort of spur. There were some spurs, you know, and some thorns there, which, look, I wouldn't have it any other way with her, you know, because she is a consummate artist and she likes to make it challenging no matter what. So, but it was so funny. She was like, oh, I didn't really listen to the lead vocal. I just sort of did what I wanted. And I was furious. I was utterly furious. But then...
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
It is really interesting what she did. So it's this like... Whatever, what do you do?
It's amazing that we all have each other like that. You know what I mean? Yes. It's just like, it's so special. I do think about this pool of queer artists and people, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time, and I treasure that.
Yes. And I will say, actually, you know, for a long time, and when we met, I had just finished one. Aunt Anoni was really starting to really rise. But before that, like those early records, my first and second record, I did feel totally alone. I did feel totally isolated and like I was out there fighting the battle myself. But it was really when you got your success and Anoni got her success that I could actually say, oh no, there are others. I'm part of a gang, and you were definitely part of that. So I felt it very much too when your record came out. I was relieved.
For listeners, Rufus and I went on a date together.
We did. We drove all the way to Philly. We
went to go see Ween in Philly. Yeah, it was so fun. It was so fun.
Yeah.
George Michael covered
this
song.
Yes.
What a cover.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is one of my, you know, the high points of my career is that fact, you know, that he covered that song. And there is a slight, I mean, it's hilarious when you tell the story, but of course the fact that he died makes it not at all funny. But I got word that he wanted to talk to me. I was in London at the time. I was on tour, and I didn't know about what. I think I was getting off a tour of Europe, and we arrived in London. It was like 3 a.m, and suddenly my phone rang, and it was George Michael. And I thought, oh, George, he must be in L.A. or something, or... And he's like, oh, no, I'm in London. And I was like, oh, okay, great. And then he just started talking. He's like, I just want to talk to you about, you know, going to a town. It's such an amazing song. It's such an important thing. And I was so thrilled. And he was talking about how much he loved it and going on and on. And after about, I'd say about 7 or 8 minutes, I kept trying to, you know, interject and say, oh, thank you. But I just realized that it was impossible for me to kind of return any comments in this conversation, because he just was talking and talking and talking and talking, and obviously he was on something, and he was going on and on and on and on. So at a certain point I just didn't say anything, and I sat there, and he talked for about an hour and a half, just going on about this and how his life is this and the song, and he's trying to pay the world, and then he fell asleep on the phone. And I just sort of hung up. He later apologized. He was just on some kind of thing. And look, it was entertaining. It was an honor. I don't judge him in any way. And I would never want to change it. But I mean, it's unfortunate that he died of addiction, really. So
it's just one of the most heartbreaking things, I think, ever.
Yeah.
His death.
Totally.
I still look at pictures of him, and I'm just like, he should still be with us.
No, I know.
It's
totally,
just like,
totally.
That one, it devastated me.
And I think also, especially because he was such a good man. I mean, he was
very
obviously
sweet
a great artist and all of that. But it just seemed like he was also this really tortured but kind and innocent person in a lot of ways.
His version of the song is stunning.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank him.
Do you feel a connection with other gay artists from other generations and kind of being part of that legacy. Is that something that occurs to you?
Oh, yeah. No, it always has. Look, when I'm a little older than you, and I also came out when I was very young. I was 13 when I knew what was going on. And so it was like 1987, and AIDS was killing everybody, and it was, you know, the Reagan years and so forth. So it was pretty dramatic. And I wholeheartedly had to escape into the history of gay men, especially in the arts, you know, whether it was Oscar Wilde or Tchaikovsky or Jean Cocteau or Jean Genet. Like, I needed that literature and music and sensibility to really kind of save my life in a lot of ways, at least mentally, because what I was up against was so horrific, and I was so young. And that's when I, you know, became a huge opera fan and stuff. And so, yeah, I've always relied heavily on material from the past.
Well, you and I both came of age, you know, when AIDS was still, before the cocktail was created.
Yeah.
And I came out very young as well. I was 15, but that was in 92, right, I think,
right,
93.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, I think there is a delineation, right? We are from a certain generation and growing up with that fear and the darkness.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about coming out that young is your parents at that time. And the fear that your parents had for me as a 15-year-old at that time. And I think that even sort of made, you know, it's a very specific kind of moment and a specific kind of dynamic with parents fearing for their children.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was it like with your mom and dad?
No, my parents were terrible. my mother, too. I mean, she was a decent, you know, educated, smart person. And but they just were so scared and also a little bit, how can I say it, unprepared for this concept. And you know, my mom kind of threatened to throw me out of the house at one point, and my dad didn't really want to talk about it. So I was pretty much on my own through the whole saga. Later on, you know, they came around and so forth. But yeah, no, not their brightest moment, which I forgive them, of course. But I'm also a little bit, it still reverberates with me. It's still something that I have to contend with, and just the makeup of who I am psychologically, because I was just faced with so much when I was so young. I mean, she's 12, my daughter Viva, she will be 13 very soon, but I was looking at her the other day and I was like, wow, when I was that age, I was really, I was going through a lot. I mean, I'm not saying that she isn't either, because there's probably a whole bunch of things that she's going through that I have no concept of either. I'm sure there's a similar kind of disconnect. But in terms of, you know, I was going to bars, I was listening to opera, I thought I was going to die from AIDS, you know, I was having sex. Like, it was like very, it was pretty wild how crazy things were when I was that age.
I remember when your first album came out and I had it on CD. I was, I don't know, 18 or 19. Yeah. And it was just so cool to see an out artist that was your age from the get-go.
Yeah.
Like, how did it feel for you in the music industry at that time?
Well, that's very interesting, because I was totally out. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but when I had my first ever meeting with the record executives, it was Mo Austin and Lenny Waronker, the two of them. We had lunch, and it was at Morton's in Hollywood. And I remember what I was wearing. I was wearing like a little checkered blazer and sort of these like green pants and like clogs or something. Like, I had this funny outfit, and I sat down, and these were the two of the most famous. I mean, Mo Austin signed Frank Sinatra and Jimi Hendrix. I mean, these were like the top of the heap. And I sat down and I said, before we start this conversation, I just need you to know one thing. And they're like, okay. And it was like, I'm gay, I'm out, I'm not pretending that I'm straight or anything. And then we can proceed. And they're like, okay, we got it. And so it was the first thing that I settled. And it wasn't out of any moral or kind of like gay rights thing. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with AIDS, because the whole Rock Hudson thing had happened, and, you know, Liberace, and I had witnessed this horrible thing where you had these actors who were closeted, who then had to like die and come out at the same time, and just, it just seemed so horrific to me. So my thought was like, if I get AIDS, then I don't have to come out as well. that was my reasoning.
Oh my God.
So
oh my God.
So that was what I was thinking, and they agreed, and then we moved forward. And it wasn't even understood at all, even when my record came out. I mean, people were like, oh, he's gay, and they didn't even know how to deal with it. It's like when you beat them to the punch a little bit. Like, they didn't, I think because it was so new and it was so kind of amorphous, they didn't know what to do. It was better in a weird way, because there was no plan. It wasn't like, you know, mapped out.
So you weren't necessarily frustrated necessarily by coverage that you were getting at the time.
They didn't even want to talk about it so much because it was so weird to talk about.
Wow.
I would talk about it and they'd be like, oh, that's cool. And then, okay. Then we'd move on to something else. And this is quite cynical and quite sad, is that I don't think that they knew how to monetize it yet. You know, like, it was later when you started to get certain people like Adam Lambert or other people where, like, they could really turn it into this sort of, and I'm not accusing him of that. I just don't think the system knew how to really turn it into a profitable set thing. So it really wasn't of any use to them. I was told, like, several times, like, why don't you pretend to be bisexual, and then you can kind of, like, play a bit like a Bowie thing, like, make, or, like, just be androgynous, and that people don't quite know, and that's more marketable. But I was like, if you just say you're out gay, they're like, oh, well, I guess we'll lose some of these people, and maybe some of these people appreciate it. They look at it very coldly.
I found a quote from you from a recent interview that I thought was amazing, that I really identified with. You said, when you start, you have to be somewhat of a monster. It's unfortunate to say that, but I know very few successful musicians today who weren't completely nuts when they started out.
Yeah, that's true.
It spoke to me.
Yeah, it spoke
to me because I often look back at myself in my 20s and just think, my God, I could just be such an asshole.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that for a second? And do you think that being gay made that almost more of a thing?
Yeah. It's one of those things of, it doesn't really matter what the reviews are, it matters how much it weighs, you know, in the sense. And so I felt like whatever I had to do, and this was the correct instinct, I just had to make an impression. And the gay thing became part of that toolkit. And it wasn't like I walked in there, well, a little bit, actually. I did walk in there a little bit, you know, in the bathrobe and with the cigarette and stuff. Yeah, I know I did that. I did that, actually. But I knew deep down that it was the music and the, you know, and I wanted, when I sat at the piano or I played the guitar and sang something, it had to be, you know, engaging as well on its own level. So yeah, I was using every type of flare gun I could, you know, get my hands on, and being gay became one of them. Also being, you know, from a family of musicians, I kind of presented myself as this, like, inheritor, you know, part of the kind of nepotistic, you know, aristocracy. And then also being, I was fairly good looking at the time. You know, I wasn't afraid to, you know, play that card a little bit.
Still are, Rufus. You still are. Handsome man.
So I was kind of throwing everything at the wall. It is dangerous territory. I mean, it does a number on you, for sure. And thankfully, I was able to, you know, rein it in eventually at times, or I had people in my life who could sort of calm me down and who knew that I was deep down a good person and stuff. So I think a lot of that has to do with fame, in the sense that, you know, I became quite well known and I got a lot of fame and I went on a big journey, but I never had that bona fide, you know, number one kind of like overload. Unlike yourself, I mean, I didn't have a hit single, like a real one. I think that if I had had that happen to me, I don't know how I would have fared. Maybe I would have been okay, but there's a good chance that I also would have been taken down by that, especially with drugs involved and everything, because I was really struggling with that as well. So
I think that fact is probably, like, you know, as far as the journey of where your music's gone, I think it's probably given you more freedom in so many ways.
It has.
To do exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
Do you give advice ever to younger queer artists? Do you have advice for younger queer artists?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the main piece of advice is to really relish in the work of what you're doing. It's really the process that is by far the most exciting part of it. And yes, it's great to be nominated for awards. It's great to play in stadiums if you can get there. And, you know, there's a thrill in being on the cover of magazines. I don't doubt that. But if you don't love the actual nitty-gritty of getting in there and writing a song or working in the studio with other musicians and really cherish that as like the most important thing, then I don't know. All I know is that for me, as someone who's had to do this now for 40 years, if you think of like when I really started, but really enjoy it, and it's gotten deeper and better and more fulfilling, is that I just really, as I said, cherish the process.
It's the best part.
Yeah, it is.
The news recently that you're coming to London and doing your first musical, which is so thrilling, and the story that you're doing is so thrilling.
Yes, yes.
Can you talk about it for a second?
I've written a musical with my friend, the great Ivo van Hove, the director, Belgian director, and it's based on Cassavetes' Opening Night, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, with Jenna Rollins from 1976. We have an incredible cast so far. We have Sheridan Smith and a bunch of other incredible people. Yeah, it's my first, I would say, bona fide musical attempt, in the sense that I've written a couple of operas. I've done some artsy kind of musical-y things in Germany and so forth. But this is like a real, you know, no holds barred musical for the West End in London.
It's one of my favorite movies too. I love that movie. And just when I found out that you were doing it, it's so exciting. I cannot wait to see it. This has been so fantastic talking to you, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time. And I love you, Rufus.
I think you're
amazing. I love your music so much. We got to perform together at Royal Albert Hall, and it was, but just getting to perform with you a few months back, was really special to get on stage with you and sing. It really meant the world.
It was great fun.
And thank you for today.
Okay, thank you.
My huge thanks to Rufus Wainwright. It was so awesome to get to talk to him and learn about the genesis of this amazing song. And that brings us to the end of the series. I've loved talking to all of these artists I've met. It's been fascinating hearing their stories and discovering the similarities, but also some of the differences between all of our experiences and the music. From Sylvester's Mighty Reel to Self-Esteem's I Do This All the Time, Erasure's The Little Respect, and Peaches' Fuck the Pain Away, this is beautiful, meaningful, and daring music making. I still don't know what I think about the idea of queer music, whether it exists or not, whether it's a real thing, but I am flabbergasted by the creativity of the LGBTQ+ artists I've spoken to, and I'm really proud to be part of that legacy myself. So if you've missed any episodes, I thoroughly recommend you go back and check them out. All right, it's over and out for me for now. Thanks for accompanying me on this journey, and you know what I'm gonna say here. Come on, let's finish up on a song. Crank up the volume, take a deep breath, and enjoy Going to a Town by Rufus Wainwright.
I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm gonna see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America. I'm gonna make it up for all of the Sunday times. I'm gonna make it up for all of the nursery rhymes that never really seem to want to tell the truth. everything that you've done is good. I really need to know, after soaking the body of Jesus Christ in blood, I'm so tired.
I'm Debbie Millman, and I host a podcast called Design Matters from the TED Audio Collective. Every episode, I have conversations with designers, writers, artists, and other luminaries of contemporary thought, people like Roman Mars, Ai Weiwei, Ethan Hawke, and Ashley Ford. We not only talk about their crafts, but how they design the arc of their lives, what they've learned, what obstacles they've overcome and how they've done it, and how they see the world. Join us for an inquiry into the broader world of creative culture. Find and follow Design Matters with Debbie Millman wherever you're listening to this.